This week on Making Contact.
What labor needs to do is to adjust to the changing demographics of the American workforce.
There is no real contact between day laborers and Americans. They don't share the same language, they don't share the same culture. Both are fearful of the other.
For most, Labor Day is just another national holiday, a day off of work, time to spend with families and friends. The beaches and parks are packed and the roads congested as everyone says goodbye to another summer gone by. But on this edition of Making Contact, we focus on the root of this American holiday, the contemporary condition of American labor. I'm Tina Rubio, your host this week on Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information. Labor Day, a national holiday more than 100 years old, a day dedicated to the social and economic achievements of America's labor force, an annual tribute to the contributions workers have made to the prosperity and strength of this country. But for many, Labor Day is something different.
Now, what is Labor Day? What is it?
I don't know. For some reason, I want to say it's military-related, but I don't think so.
Labor Day? It's a day to celebrate labor.
It really doesn't matter to me. I'm just happy to get out of school, so.
Actually, I don't even know when Labor Day is.
Labor Day is celebrated on the first Monday in September. Its origins disputed. Some say American Federation of Labor co-founder Peter J. McGuire was first in suggesting a day to honor the working class. Others attribute it to a self-serving attempt by President Grover Cleveland as a gesture of appeasement toward an angry American working class after the highly publicized federal crushing of the Pullman, Illinois Railroad strike in 1894. But it's also been said the holiday arose out of the first Knights of Labor parade held in New York, September 5, 1882, that paid tribute to America's working class. Whatever the origins of Labor Day, it's the political impact and social meaning of this day of dedication and activism that takes center stage. He was the voice for migrant farm workers, a Mexican-American farm labor activist who sought social justice through peaceful means on behalf of the people who toiled in the fields, workers of American soil who labored to provide Americans inexpensive produce and America's agribusiness with untold wealth. His name? Cesar Chavez. Chavez's life as a community organizer began in 1952 when he joined the Community Service Organization, a prominent Latino civil rights group. It was there that Chavez got his first taste of organizing and leading protest campaigns against economic and racial discrimination. But Chavez had another dream.
All my life, I have been driven by one dream, one goal, one vision: to overthrow a farm labor system in this nation that treats farm workers as if they were not important human beings.
Through his tireless organizing efforts and a five-year farm worker strike waged against a system that discriminated, bullied, and threatened Latino workers, eventually got the nation's attention. And in 1962, the National Farm Workers Association, now known as the United Farm Workers of America, was born, the first successful farm workers union in American history. Today, in that same spirit of Cesar Chavez, there are hundreds of organizations across the country still fighting for the rights of immigrant labor workers, one of those in Seattle, Washington. It's called Casa Latina, and it helps to get day laborers off the streets and into jobs. But as freelance reporter Sarah Gustavus reports, negative perceptions and discrimination within the very communities they serve are hard to break.
This is how we start the day, with the raffle.
It's 6:30 in the morning in downtown Seattle, and workers are starting a new week. In the Belltown neighborhood, just a few streets north of downtown high-rises, a group of mostly Latino men are ready for the daily raffle that connects employers to really temporary employees, otherwise known as day laborers. They line up at Casa Latina's gates each morning with fresh hope that they will get a good job for today.
7:11.
Frank has a wife, children, and an 80-year-old grandmother to support with the wages he earns as a day laborer.
My family is staying in my country, El Salvador. I have my wife and my kids. I have 5 kids. In my country, it's too cheap. You're working. There's a day you're winning $5 every day, only $5.
After being called in groups of 12, workers like Frank don orange vests and wait for the contractors who arrive in trucks and vans to pick up their willing workers. Seattle's Belltown neighborhood used to house warehouses, union halls, artist studios, and mostly a white day labor force. Soaring modern apartment buildings now dwarf the tiny Casa Latina trailer, which reminds the neighborhood of what it used to be. As the demographics of the neighborhood changed, so did the hurdles this population faced. Casa Latina's executive director, Hillary Stern.
In the early 90s, the Belltown underwent extreme gentrification and development. And so that bore a lot of pressure on the day laborers, because at the same time that this was happening, the day labor population was increasing. So the business association actually approached us and asked us to participate in discussions for how to get the laborers off the streets. And we saw that as something that was to our advantage to get people off the street, because we could protect them better if they were in a center.
The organization originally began offering ESL classes and workshops to day laborers in 1994. 6 years later, it expanded its mission by adding the Day Worker Center, which brings a sense of order to the chaotic nature of casual labor. Daniel Anguino started as a day laborer and worked his way up to coordinator of the center. He says that Casa Latina makes the streets safer.
If there were no worker center here, we were not here, there would be everybody fighting for the jobs. To the employers, you know, running through the cars and stuff like that.
Today, the Migrant Policy Institute says documented workers make up 14% of the U.S. labor force. And the Urban Institute, a nonprofit research association, reports an additional 6 million undocumented workers in the labor force. And that number is expected to keep rising. By the end of this year, Casa Latina will serve about 1,000 workers, and their efforts have earned support from organizations like the Washington State Labor Council. Communications Director Karen Kaiser.
All working people benefit when working people aren't exploited, because it's always a race to the bottom. If you can exploit a day laborer in Seattle and pay them money under the table instead of paying them a decent wage with benefits, we all pay one way or the other, because if that individual gets hurt on the job or gets sick, someone's going to take care of him, because the benefits haven't been paid for, the insurance hasn't been paid for, so the taxpayer pays for him.
Helping reduce chaos and protect workers' legal rights may be good for taxpayers and workers, but neighborhood residents complain that they are still waiting on the street. Casa Latina's workers can't all stand inside their small lot, so there is no way to distinguish between the day laborers and other denizens of the street, like drug dealers, prostitutes, and homeless people. Casa Latina recognizes that they are associated with these street problems, but Executive Director Stern says this is a cultural misunderstanding.
They are, in one way, really in your face, because they are, they're right there on the street, very, very visible. People have to walk by them. On the other hand, there is no real contact between day laborers and Americans. They don't share the same language. They don't share the same culture. Both are fearful of the other.
The fear of day laborers and crime in the streets is bad for business, and Orfelia, owner of Salon de Orfelia, says the situation is getting worse.
Looking right now, who is in my front of my business is a crazy woman, is a homeless, and an Indian. They're drunk, and what they're doing is smoking pot, but they are not Latinos. So that way I say it's very careful what I say, because it's not all the Latinos, it's the people when it's around there.
She isn't sure if crime will go down when Casa Latina moves, but she isn't staying long enough to find out. After 7 years in the Belltown neighborhood, she is moving her business next month. Those who are staying are overwhelmed by the combination of day laborers and other people on the streets. One block away, El Basha Cafe owner Gary Aborob says,
"So yeah, I would really love to see them go away. Not because I hate them or anything, but I'd rather either some like police car stays here 24 hours to really make it safer place, or just move somewhere else."
In spite of these complaints, Casa Latina is being forced out of the neighborhood for a different reason. The Day Labor Center has a temporary lease on land owned by the City of Seattle, and the city wants its land back to rebuild the highway that runs just behind the center. Casa Latina sees this as an opportunity to combine the services they offer, and they believe the problems on the downtown streets won't follow them.
Even the workers, you know, sometimes they don't want to walk around the block because there's many trouble around.
Day Worker Center Coordinator Anguiano.
You know, I just want to let everybody know that this place is very safe, and it's, we are all these people as woodworkers that we have here. And if there is other people around us, there is not much we can do, but I would like to change that to get a new building and to go there and to demonstrate everyone who we are.
Last spring, they thought they found it in the more affordable and diverse Rainier Valley neighborhood. And they were backed by three city council members who earmarked funds for Casa Latina. But after announcing its plans to buy an old warehouse, many Rainier Valley residents expressed opposition. Citizens like Joby Moore had several concerns, including the close proximity to schools and their struggle to feel respected.
The Rainier Valley is the south end of Seattle. It used to be a farming area and has, over the years, been an easy place for the city to kind of place the things that no other neighborhood wanted.
Moore isn't convinced that the problems of Belltown won't follow Casa Latina, but she says Casa Latina shouldn't be forced to carry all of the responsibility.
Day labor is a good thing. They need work. It exists. It's here. And obviously people hire day laborers. So I think since it's a citywide issue, the city should address the needs, not just shunt it from one neighborhood to another and pit the neighborhoods against each other.
Immigrant day laborers say they are simply looking for better opportunities in the United States. But as disposable workers, they are some of the most vulnerable members of the economy. Casa Latina may indeed be like a small town within the city of Seattle, but it's a community that is clinging together out of necessity, weathering the storm of politics and social pressures they can't control. For Making Contact, I'm Sarah Gustavus.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information, or for cassette or CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit us on the web at radioproject.org. Formed in 1955, the AFL-CIO is a voluntary federation of America's unions. In the 50s, the organization was at its peak, with close to 50% of all American workers belonging to a union under its guiding hand. But over the years, the numbers have steadily declined. Just last year, a mere 12.5% of American laborers were associated with this seminal American labor organization. And on what was supposed to be a celebration of the golden anniversary of the AFL-CIO merger at this summer's Chicago convention, the tables turned on the 50-year-old American institution. What emerged is the largest rift in organized labor since the 1930s. Freelance reporter Tom Harriman takes a look at what this rift in American organized labor means.
A debate that raged for more than a year in the highest councils of the labor movement came to a climax in early August when three major unions quit the AFL-CIO, the National Coalition of Labor, and formed their own alliance, Change to Win. The service employees, United Food and Commercial Workers, and the Teamsters say that leaving the AFL-CIO will help put more emphasis on organizing and less on politics. That, many hope, will result in a stronger labor movement overall. The departing unions and two other unions in the Change to Win coalition, Unite Here and the Laborers, represent 40% of the membership of the AFL-CIO. They say the AFL-CIO has the wrong strategy to cope with organized labor's declining numbers and its declining influence in the economy and in politics. They say getting out and starting over will invigorate labor nationwide and help workers regain their lost economic and political power. Mike Zuber is a security guard at a downtown Seattle office building. He's helping to organize a union where he works, Local 6 of the service employees. Zuber supports his union's actions in leaving the AFL-CIO.
The sort of old guard of labor, the AFL, they're sort of holding on to a status quo. And they represent a time when labor was primarily manufacturing, production jobs. And in the last 10 or so years, those jobs are not staying in the United States. They're being shipped out overseas. And what labor needs to do is to adjust to the changing demographics of the American workforce. And that is moving in the direction of organizing the service sector of the economy.
Zuber also talked about the relationship between unions and politicians.
And so the money that has been going to these Democratic candidates, they've sort of been taking it for granted. And what they really need to do, they need to essentially earn it. I mean, prove to us that you support, you know, the interests of the working poor.
The real impact of the split may be felt most heavily in local unions and state and county labor councils across the country, where much of the nuts and bolts work of the labor movement gets done. Tom Leadham, Secretary-Treasurer of Teamsters Local 206 in Portland, Oregon.
The initial impact was really devastating for many central labor councils and many state feds just because of the loss of income as a result of the split.
In the Seattle area, most unions belong to the King County Labor Council. At election time, union volunteers inundate neighborhoods across the city to doorbell all the union members from every union. That's been their most effective political weapon. The mayor, two port commissioners, and a dozen or more state legislators have been elected with the help of Labor Neighbor. But the head of the Labor Council, Steve Williamson, thinks such programs are threatened.
We have one list that we share, right, all the different unions, and in the split, it's impossible for us to knock on one another's doors. It means we have two smaller lists, you know, and it means that we'll be much less efficient and much less able to really do the political work, which I think is something that all progressives care about, not just labor union members. Elected officials, candidates, really want our support and they work hard for it because we got political clout. The split hurts that, and that's something that's a big concern to me.
In 2000, the entire Seattle labor movement rallied around a small group of aerospace engineers when their fledgling union, SPEA, struck Boeing. Much of the support effort was coordinated by the King County Labor Council. One of the strikers, Joel Funfar, remembers what that was like.
And so we voted to go on strike, and we'd never been on strike before, and we didn't have any strike fund or anything. And from, you know, day one and even before that, people taught us how to do picket captain training. And then when we did go on strike, all the unions from all around the country really supported us, whether it was sending money to our strike fund, and all the local unions all really came out and really supported us.
Now, because of the split, Funfar is not so sure that a small union facing a tough fight will have the same level of support.
The people that are really going to get hurt in this split are the rank-and-file unions and the state labor councils and the local labor councils. I don't think anybody likes this, and I think that's sad because I think it's hard on everybody.
Throughout the disaffiliation debate, the departing unions have maintained they want to continue to work with state and local labor councils. But at first, this idea was angrily rejected by the AFL-CIO. President John Sweeney received a standing ovation from the delegates at the convention in Chicago when he said, "We must reject the free rider approach of the disaffiliated unions. We will not allow this federation to be turned into an open shop operation." Local leaders like Steve Williamson were appalled. They didn't want to lose the dues income and the energy and the numbers of some of their largest, most active local unions. So Sweeney offered a compromise, solidarity charters. A solidarity charter would allow local unions to leave the National Federation but still stay in the local bodies. But there's a catch. Those union members won't be eligible to be elected leaders in state and local bodies, and members will still have to pay their normal dues plus a 10% surcharge, like a restocking fee. And that's not all. Solidarity charter members will also have to sign a loyalty oath promising to try to persuade their parent union to hitch back up to the AFL-CIO. So far, reaction to Sweeney's proposal has been hostile. SEIU Vice President Anna Berger, who heads the Change to Win Coalition, says the solidarity charters use the rhetoric of unity but are designed to provoke unnecessary division. She called them a poison pill. Tom Leadham thinks the solidarity charters could be a recipe for more dissension.
And I would expect that there would be considerable resentment, either in the short term or perhaps in the long term, over that kind of arrangement. So all of this is really up in the air, and it remains to be seen, you know, how these ideas are implemented and who, in fact, is willing to participate.
One group that hasn't had much of a voice in this whole debate is the vast majority of rank-and-file union members. Mike Zuber, the security guard, says he's taken part in many discussions at Local 6 and in other SEIU meetings about those issues. But many people on both sides of the argument feel there wasn't enough involvement of rank-and-file members. Tom Leadham.
In most unions, there's been little or no discussion. And unfortunately, in the Teamsters, that's been the case. I think that's unfortunate. I don't think we can have a thorough discussion and debate and really understand the ramifications of these decisions on working people if rank-and-file union members aren't involved in the discussion.
Steve Williamson also thinks many people felt left out of the debate.
I think there was also a lot of people at the local level who felt that there was really, you know, 9 white guys and a white woman who were back in D.C. deciding these things. And I think people felt pretty helpless that the movement was going to be turned in a direction without input from people out in the all across the country.
Leadham says the labor movement is facing a much bigger challenge than who belongs to what federation. He is disappointed the debate never focused on the crucial question of the state of union democracy.
There was very little, if any, discussion of accountability of the decision makers and how we could improve democracy in the labor movement and really have direct democracy where rank and file workers have more of a voice and an ability to hold the leadership accountable. So I think people really saw that as a missing element in this discussion, and it really should have been central to the debate.
Whether the split will prove good or bad for American workers in the long run is impossible to say right now. Some say labor will be reinvigorated. Others see unions getting weaker in a time of great peril. But one thing is clear. Questions surrounding the state of our unions will be discussed for months and years to come as the labor movement tries to recover its balance and solidarity after a season of dissension and schism. For Making Contact, I'm Tom Harriman in Seattle, Washington.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. The living heritage of the American labor movement can be found throughout American life. We see it in songbooks, posters, murals, poems, and in the oral history passed down by those who came before us. We also find it in the picket lines and demonstrations of the contemporary labor movement. And once every year, workers from across the nation join forces to share songs, art, and poetry that reflect the ideas and the emotions of the labor movement as they preserve and carry on traditions of our collective labor heritage. Freelance reporter Douglas Calvin.
Julius Margolin is a labor activist, has been since the 1930s. He's a former merchant marine seaman and decorated World War II veteran who organized extensively for the Council of Industrial Organizations, or CIO, during the 1930s and 40s. And to this day, the 89-year-old is still fighting the good fight.
And we were spent the night in jail. About 4 months later, we came up before the judge, and he looks down and he sees us older people and the students who sat in. He says, I can see that there's no generation gap here.
For the past 27 years, the Great Labor Arts Exchange sets up camp at the George Meany National Labor College in Silver Spring, Maryland. It brings together people from all walks of life, including union members and staff, and various artists, labor educators, and youth, who use the arts not only to strengthen the labor movement, but help define it.
The old song give you the history. You don't get a history in school, you get a bunch of lies.
Faith Petrick has been singing folk music for 86 years, and speaks about the importance of old and new songs for young people today.
In the old songs, you get the history of what's happening. The song, what happened to people, this strike, that mining disaster, all of you. That's where you find it, is in the song. But a lot more than that, songs give people strength. That's one thing they do. Singing together draws it, something more than the individual. It becomes something that's more than the sum of its parts, you know. And gives you courage, and if they writing their own songs, their experiences, what's happening to them without the Moon June stuff, the reality, what's going on in their life. Write this down in songs and in poetry. And it's fulfilling, it's liberating, and helps you grow and be strong. I don't know.
We get stepped on, abused, ignored, and confused.
The atmosphere is dynamic. You can participate in a jam session, take part in a variety of workshops, or get tips on how to organize. Whatever your passion, the Great Labor Arts Exchange provides an outlet for people to share their own personal experiences in the labor movement. Caminante member Liliana Herrera, Julius, and others participated in this year's youth organizing workshop.
I really think that that inspiration has to come from somewhere. And if you learn, how can you be inspired to do anything, right? How can you inspire to be a new union or be progressive or say no to the war? It's you have to learn about history and other people's plight, other people's struggles. And when they were young, it's not like, you know, oh, this old guy is telling me, you know, this hierarchy. No, wait a minute. He was young once and he was struggling, maybe going through the depression, maybe living through worse times that I can't even imagine.
The exchange also brings together rank and file union members with some of the most dedicated and talented arts activists from around the country. That includes a who's who of influential singers over the years. That list includes Joe Glazer, Bev Grant, Ann Feeney, John Fromer, Joe Jenks, and many others. Youth performers last year included Pakistani-American poet Sheila Mirza and Milwaukee-based activist and violist Ursula Milnarek, ages 19 and 15.
So I decided to investigate. Sir, what happened? He said, random checking. But why am I always random? Seldom do I just pass. Oh, I wish he was honest and said the system's racist. Instead, he stuck to random checking. Told me to put my clothes back on.
The exchange represents the diversity of music, spoken word, and arts organizing that is the lifeblood of today's labor movement. Rick and Memo grew up in the farm workers movement and formed La Paz, one of LA's most dynamic hip-hop acts. They mix club beats, conscious lyrics, and a strong following in what they call La Paz abilities.
Good food from the good earth. Don't make me laugh. That's like Mother Nature taking the toxic bath. And with the screwed up system, they're able to put these products upon your dinner table. The farm worker, conditioned, critical. Now how them growers get permission is political. Poisonous where they work and they live.
Labor culture and arts activism, from Woody Guthrie, Joe Hill, and Paul Robeson, to the singers and organizers on today's picket lines, represents the heart and soul of the labor movement. In an era of war, globalization, anti-immigrant, and hate-motivated violence, unity can be forged by cultural exchanges and the arts.
Caminando, caminando.
Like any great tradition, the songs, images, and stories motivate, inspire, and support generations of labor activists. Caminante, a family trio, does just that, crossing borders and boundaries with traditions of working-class struggle. Liliana and her brothers Rafael and Francisco join voices with the audience in singing Caminando, We Walk Together.
Caminando, caminando. Vamos caminando hacia la libertad.
For Making Contact, I'm Douglas Calvin in Washington, D.C.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Thanks for listening. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Making Contact is an independent production funded primarily by generous gifts from people in the community. We are committed to providing a unique forum for voices and opinions not often heard in the mass media. For a cassette or CD copy of program number 3505, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. Lisa Rudman is our executive director. Justin Beck and Pauline Bartoloni, associate producers. Dorian Taylor, communications manager. Esther Mania, outreach coordinator. Tom Evans, development associate. Emily Polk, production fellow. Megan Kaiser and Lawton Chan, production interns. I'm Tina Rubio. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.